face. The explosion sent a fireball crashing around his body. Glass shattered. A car alarm wailed. His ears started ringing. He felt like his head was inside of a gong. The heat was like a sauna. Jeffrey tried to stand. He lost his balance. His knee pounded into the asphalt.
Help!
Daryl was still in the car. He was stuck. He rammed his shoulder against the door, furiously trying to get out. His screams were like a siren.
Chief!
Dawson was 50 yards away. His arms pumped as he ran.
Help!
Daryl yelled. He was halfway out of the car.
Help me!
Jeffrey stumbled across the road. The heat felt like it was chewing at his face.
Help!
Daryl screamed. Fire licked at his back. He was folded over the door, clawing at the ground. His leg was caught inside. He couldn't get out.
Please! Help me!
Jeffrey dodged the flames. He grabbed Daryl's wrists and pulled.
Harder!
Daryl started kicking at the steering wheel with his free leg. The flame shot higher. The heat was melting the paint off the car. Jeffrey could see the flat metal bottom of the gas tank glowing red.
Pull!
Daryl begged. Jeffrey leaned back, using every ounce of weight in his body.
No!
Daryl screamed.
Oh, God! No!
Jeffrey felt something pop. The release was like a champagne cork flying across the room. His body fell backward. Daryl Nesbitt collapsed on top of him. Jeffrey tried to shift him off. The gas tank was going to blow.
Chief!
Dawson grabbed Jeffrey under his arms. He dragged him away from the flames. Someone threw water on his face. Someone else wrapped a jacket around his shoulders. Jeffrey coughed up a pool of black liquid onto the ground. His eyes were burning. His skin felt singed. The hair had burned off his arms.
Chief,
Matt said. Brad was with him. Cheshire, Hendricks, Dawson. Jeffrey rolled over. Blood dripped down his throat. His nose was broken again. He turned his head. Daryl Nesbitt was flat on his back, arms out, eyes closed, unmoving. Just like Tommy Humphrey. Just like Becky Catarino. Just like Leslie Truong. Jeffrey pushed himself up on his elbow. He saw a thick line of blood in the grass that traced all the way back to the burning car. He followed the line to Daryl. The champagne cork. The pop had come from Daryl Nesbitt's ankle joint, as his foot had been ripped away from his leg. Atlanta, Chapter 26. Will pecked at his keyboard, carefully filling out the last box on the application for a subpoena. He had driven by the One Museum condo complex on the way to work. Callie Zanger's building superintendent hadn't appreciated being roused from bed at 5 in the morning, but the man had been coherent enough to give Will the information that he needed. There were no 2-year-old hard drives lying around. The state-of-the-art building security system was backed up to the cloud. The building's insurance company required them to store the encrypted data for 5 years. Will was asking the judge to grant the GBI access to all of the recordings from the 3 months before and after Callie Zanger's abduction. He touched his finger under each word, checking for mistakes before uploading the request to the system. He sat back in his chair. The subpoena could take as long as 4 hours to get a judge's approval. Then the lawyers would get involved. Another day might pass before the data was transferred. Streaming through over 2,000 hours of video would take more eyes than Will had in his head. He looked at the time. Amanda had called their meeting for 7 sharp. He would ask her to put a rush on the subpoena. For now, he had 8 minutes of peace before his day ramped up. He allotted himself 4 minutes to worry. First up was Faith. She had been gutted by the Callie Zanger interview. Will hadn't been much better. The drive back to headquarters had been excruciating for both of them. Faith because she was trying not to cry, and Will because seeing Faith trying so hard not to cry had made him want to break things. He craned his ear toward his open office door. Faith's door was closed. She had arrived 15 minutes ago. He could hear her poking around, but she hadn't come by, and he wasn't sure she wanted to be bothered. Will looked at the clock on his computer. 1 minute down. He let his thoughts travel to the next woman he was worried about, Sarah. The exhumation of Shay Van Dorn was not going to be easy. But that wasn't all that was troubling him. They had both fallen asleep on the couch last night, Sarah's head like dead weight on his chest. But every time Will thought about the connection between them, his brain threw up the image of an extension cord lying 2 feet away from the socket. Will couldn't figure out a way to plug back in. Sarah had told him about the U store being across the street from the cemetery, and Will had believed her when she said that she hadn't visited Jeffrey. But every time he found himself thinking about the chief, he wanted to grab Sarah, throw her over his shoulder, and lock her in a room like a caveman. Or a serial killer. Will picked at the band-aid Sarah had wrapped around his knuckle. He had never thought of himself as the jealous type. Then again, Angie had never wholly belonged to him. She'd been screwing around since she was old enough to sneak out of a window. Will had been mildly irritated by her bad reputation and furious about the syphilis. But he had found all kinds of ways to justify her non-monogamy. Angie had been damaged by so many men in her life. Sex was her way of stealing back some of that power. Will was the only man she had ever really loved. Or at least that's what she had told him. Being with Sarah, knowing what love really felt like, had exposed the extent of her lie.
"Morning, Hoss."
Nick sauntered into his office.
"Meeting's about to start."
Will thought about punching him.
"Look it, bud."
Nick sat down on the couch without being asked.
"Can I be honest with you?"
Will turned his chair to face him. Usually when someone asked if they could be honest, that meant they'd either been lying before or they were going to start lying now. Nick said,
"First time I heard you were hooking up with Sarah, I gotta admit, I wanted to kill you so dead that even God wouldn't look for your body."
Will had never hooked up with Sarah.
"You could still try."
"Nah, man, I can see where her heart is."
Will didn't know what to say, so he said nothing.
"You fuck it up, though."
Nick grinned like an angry clown.
"Take a little advice from a dead man's grave. Ain't no woman on earth as good as the one you got right there in the palm of your hand."
They locked eyes. Will ran through a few responses, but he figured throwing out a "no shit, Hoss" was probably not going to keep this pissing contest at a draw. He went with his old standard. He grunted, then nodded, then waited for Nick to leave. Will's eyes slid back to the time on his computer. Nick had run up a 1 minute deficit. Faith's office was on the way to the stairs. Will did the door knock walk in thing to tell her it was time for the meeting. The words got caught in his throat. Faith's head was on the desk. Her face was buried in her arm. Will swallowed, trying to find the right thing to say.
"Faith?"
She turned her head, squinting at Will.
"I am so fucking hungover."
Will's relief was cut by exasperation. He had never been a fan of alcohol. When he was a kid, a drunk adult generally meant Will was about to take a beating.
"It's almost 7.
Super.
Faith gathered up her notebook and Starbucks coffee. Her clothes were wrinkled. She had dark circles under her eyes.
"Amanda and Mom forced me into choir practice last night. I passed out when they started talking about their chips fantasies."
Will winced.
"Right?" Faith closed the door behind her. I totally get horn-dogging over Eric Estrada, but Larry Wilcox? Seriously, Amanda?
So you two are okay?
Yeah. I'm not gonna change. She's not gonna change. Naysayer's gonna nay.
Faith laughed.
And that is my third and last horse joke in as many days.
Will wasn't sure it was a joke, but he was glad to hear Faith back to her usual sarcastic self. He held open the door to the stairs. Faith's voice echoed off the concrete as she told him a story about her ex taking Emma and some of her friends to play at the Fun Zone.
Welcome to parenthood, my dude.
Faith cackled.
You paid $60 to expose your kid to a communicable disease.
Will held open the next door. Faith started another story. He let his thoughts wander back to Sarah. He could still feel the weight of her head on his chest. The way she had looked at him last night was different. She was hesitant. She was still worried about his feelings. Will felt petty, because a deep, dark, maybe even sadistic part of him liked the idea of her being unsure. Amanda was not in her office, but Nick had already snagged a spot on the couch. His cowboy boot rested on the edge of the coffee table. Faith sat next to him, diving into the usual small talk. Will leaned his back against the wall, which he had done so many times before that he was surprised his shoulder blades hadn't worn an indentation into the cinder block. He heard the clop of Amanda's tiny feet approaching. She looked exactly the same as she did every day. Salt and pepper helmet hair, skirt and matching jacket, makeup discreetly applied. If she was hungover, she was keeping it all on the inside.
We need to make this quick.
Amanda handed Faith a stack of papers. She shot Nick a look that sent his foot to the floor. She leaned against the desk, which was generally as close as she ever came to sitting down.
I've got to drive to the Capitol this morning to brief the head of the Oversight Committee. One of our victims is in his district. I don't need his panties in a wad.
Will looked down at the pages as Faith flipped through them. He recognized some of the names of the 13 law enforcement jurisdictions where the bodies had been found. Amanda asked Will,
What's the subpoena you filed this morning?
Will told her about his trip to one museum.
We know from APD that there was nothing from the parking lot, but there's a camera in the hallway outside Zanger's apartment. If you could put a rush on the...
I'll call the judge on my way downtown, she said. While you're waiting, I need you to be my eyes on the Van Dorn autopsy. The second, and I do mean the second, Sarah confirms or denies that Shay Van Dorn was murdered, you are to text me, understood?
She didn't wait for a response.
She told Faith and Nick,
Your butts are in your desk chairs this morning. Go through the lists, make the appointments. Remember, we're ostensibly reviewing the collection of data regarding missing persons reports. Tread carefully as you feel people out. I don't want anyone getting suspicious. Do it
quietly, Faith said.
Amanda raised an eyebrow as they locked into a silent battle of the wills. Nick said,
Ma'am, if I may.
Amanda took her time looking in his direction.
I've been thinking about Daryl Nesbitt,
Nick said.
I know it's clear to just about everybody in this building how I felt about Jeffrey Tolliver, but it's hard for me to think that he got this case so damn wrong.
Amanda rolled her hand to keep him talking. Nick asked,
What made y'all exonerate Nesbitt so fast?
Will realized that he had not been told about Heath Catarino, Becky's son. This wasn't a naysayer situation. Amanda was keeping the information in a tight circle, because the boy could be in mortal danger.
Good question.
Amanda had always been an agile liar. She barely missed a beat.
Our labs found an old DNA report from the Truong autopsy. We ran it against an envelope that Daryl Nesbitt mailed to Gerald Catarino. There wasn't a match.
Nick pulled at his beard. He was clearly looking for holes in the story. Will knew the real story, and he saw a gaping hole that none of them had spotted.
Why are we so sure Daryl is the one who licked the back of the envelope?
The office was silent, except for the fan on Amanda's computer.
Fuck!
Faith turned around to look at Will.
Con's gonna con.
Nick? Amanda picked up the phone on her desk. She stabbed in a number, telling him,
Go to the prison right now. I want a fresh buccal swab from Daryl Nesbitt in the lab by noon.
She waited until Nick was gone to put down the phone. She told Faith,
Speak.
The lab report Gerald Catarino gave me was the original, not a copy. He sent Heath's buccal swab along with the envelope from Daryl Nesbitt to an AABB-accredited, court-recognized commercial lab. They specialize in paternity cases. The report was definitive. Nesbitt was completely ruled out as Heath's father.
Will is right. That information is predicated on trusting that Nesbitt is the person who licked the envelope.
Amanda turned to Will.
Thoughts?
Nesbitt's been in prison for 8 years. Cons know more about forensic procedures and DNA than most cops do.
Faith added,
He's a chess player. Even Lena Adams figured that out. Nesbitt strategizes. He works people against each other. We know he's got access to the internet through contraband phones. He could have found out about Heath and done the same math that we all did.
Amanda nodded. She had made her decision.
Nesbitt's DNA is already in our database because he's a convicted sex offender. We need a clean chain of custody on Heath Catarino's DNA. I don't want to file a subpoena for obvious reasons.
Faith said, You want me to ask Gerald Catarino if he'll volunteer to let me take a swab of his kid's mouth? The kid he pretends is his own child, because he's terrified Becky's attacker will find out.
Will said,
I'll do it, Faith said. Will's on the exhumation. He's waiting for the subpoena on the security footage. We both got jobs to do.
Good,
Amanda said.
I'll put another team on the call lists. You can follow up with them when you're back.
Faith dropped the papers on the coffee table. Will's body tensed as she left. He didn't know if he wanted to stop her or go with her. Amanda said,
Wilbur, in this moment it is immaterial whether or not Daryl Nesbitt's DNA matches Heath Catarino's. What we have in front of us is an exhumed body that might offer new clues and a subpoena that could allow us access to a video that reveals the face of a killer.
Will knew a dismissal when he heard it. He tucked his hands into his pockets as he walked toward the stairs. His muscles were still tensed, but the short burst of urgency had come to a screeching halt. All that he was left with was anxiety. He didn't like the idea of Faith being alone. He was irritated that he hadn't thought to verify the DNA from the lab test. He was anxious, because Amanda was right. Nesbitt hadn't murdered 15 women and terrorized 5 others in the last 8 years. So who had? Someone with intimate knowledge of the crimes? Someone who was connected enough to Daryl Nesbitt to frame him? Someone who was clever enough to cover his tracks? Someone who had a collection of hairbands, combs, brushes, and ties?
Acolyte?
Copycat?
Nutjob?
Murderer? 2 days out, Will was asking the same questions they'd had back in the prison chapel. He exited through the door at the bottom of the stairs. The morgue was behind the headquarters building, in a metal structure that looked like a hangar. The wind whipped at his jacket as he walked up the sidewalk. Will kept his eyes on the ground. There wasn't much to look at in the sky. Dark clouds. Thunder. He could feel tiny slivers of rain stabbing at his face. A black mortuary van was parked at the loading dock. Both sets of doors were open. Gary was helping the driver transfer Shay Van Dorn's casket onto a rolling table. When Will had thought about the exhumation, he had visualized broken chunks of dirt and debris. maybe a cryptkeeper hand sticking through rotted wood. The metal casket was pristine, the black paint still mirror glossy. The only indication that it hadn't just come off the display room floor was the string of cobwebs hanging off one of the corners. A spider had managed to get sealed inside the vault. Will walked through the front lobby of the morgue. Glass windows looked into the autopsy suite. Two medical examiners were already at work. They were dressed in yellow aprons and blue scrubs, white surgical masks, colorful hats, off-white exam gloves. Sarah was in a tiny room at the end of a long hallway. Crime scene photos served as art on the walls. The back office was meant to be a temporary workspace for anyone who needed it. Desk, phone, two chairs, no window. Will slowed his pace so he could take her in. Sarah's arms were stretched out to the desk. She was staring down at her iPhone. She'd changed into scrubs. She was wearing glasses. Her long auburn hair was pinned up in a loose bun on the top of her head. Will studied her profile. I can see where her heart is. Will should be ashamed of himself, because Sarah had literally gotten down on her knees and repeatedly said that she loved Will and that she had chosen Will. But none of that had meant nearly as much as Nick Shelton casually stating that Will held Sarah in the palm of his hand. She still had not seen him. She put down her phone. He watched her open the top desk drawer. She found a tube of lotion. She started to smooth it onto her hands, then along her bare arms. Will had lingered long enough for a guy who kept telling himself he was not a serial killer. He announced his presence by telling Sarah,
"Amanda wants me to witness the autopsy."
She smiled up at him. Not her usual smile. Unsure. She said, "Mom found an email address for Delilah Humphrey. I don't know what to say." Will didn't know what to say either. He had to find a way to put things right with Sarah. This disconnection was dragging on too long. He took the chair beside the desk. He let his knee touch her leg. Sarah looked down, but the leg touch didn't seem to be enough. Will cleared his throat. He held out his uninjured hand.
My skin is a little dry, too.
Her eyebrows knit, but she played along. She massaged lotion onto his hand. He watched her fingers gently smoothing his skin. Will felt the tension in his shoulders start to smooth out, too. His breathing slowed. So did Sarah's. Slowly, finally, the air changed in the windowless room. He could tell she felt it too. She smiled as she gently squeezed each of his fingers, then used her thumb to follow the lines of his palm. Will's mother had been into astrology. He had found a palm reading poster among her belongings. He thought of the names as Sarah traced them. Lifeline, Fate Line, Headline, Heartline. Sarah looked up. He said,
"Hey."
She said, "Hey."
Like that, the plug slid back into the socket.
Sarah leaned over. She pressed her lips to his palm. She was an unusual woman. She had a thing about Jeffrey's handwriting. She had a thing about Will's hands. He asked,
"You want me to help with the email?"
"Yes, thank you." She picked up her phone again. "Can I read you what I have?"
Will nodded.
Sarah said, "There's the usual reacquaintance stuff. I gave her my cell number in case she doesn't want me to put anything on the record. Then I wrote, 'I know this is difficult, but I would like to speak with Tommy. Anything she says will be on background the same as before. Please ask her to get in touch with me, but only if she's comfortable talking. I understand and respect her right to refuse.'" Will thought about Delilah's reaction when she read the email. There wasn't a reason for the mother to write back, let alone get her daughter involved.
"Should you tell her why?"
That's the part I can't decide. Sarah put down her phone again. She held onto his hand. Tom had never believed that Daryl Nesbitt was her attacker. I showed her his booking photo. She said it wasn't him. No hesitation. Will dropped the same bomb that had sent Nick and Faith careening in opposite directions across the state.
We're retesting DNA samples from Nesbitt and Heath Catarino.
Sarah's lips parted in surprise. She saw the gaping hole more quickly than Will had. You think Daryl had someone else to lick the envelope flap?
We know that Nesbitt likes to play games, and he definitely has an axe to grind. I never met a con who didn't blame somebody else for the mess he was in.
He blamed Jeffrey for the loss of his foot. He sued for damages as part of his lawsuit.
What about the evidence?
Sarah listed it out. The hammer matched the brand and set that was found in Nesbitt's garage. He lived two streets over from the woods. He was familiar with the town. Two victims had his number in their phones. He had no alibi for the attacks. He worked on a construction site near the fire road. He drove a dark van like the one Tommy remembered. Of course, it was doubtful that Tommy would testify. Then, there was the shed. Will reminded himself to be careful. He wasn't going to trample on her dead husband's memory, at least not to her face.
I understand that he had his back to the wall because of the third missing student, Rosario Lopez. But you take away the fog of war, and that's not a great case.
You won't get any disagreement from me. That's why Jeffrey didn't push the district attorney to press charges, Sarah explained. With Nesbitt locked up, he thought more witnesses would come forward or more evidence would be found. He worked the case for another full year, trying to find something, anything that would hang the attacks on Nesbitt. But no one came forward, and he couldn't make the case. And eventually, Nesbitt managed to add attempted murder to his jacket, so... Gary knocked on the doorframe.
Dr. Linton, we're ready.
I'll be there in a second. Sarah was back on her phone. She read the words aloud as she typed. Please ask Tommy to call or email me. It is possible that she was right about the photo. How does that sound?
It depends,
Will said.
Do you want to scare her?
Shouldn't she be scared? Will said.
Send it.
Sarah waited for the email to swoosh before sticking her phone into her back pocket. She told Will, Gary's never done an exhumation, so it's gonna go slow, okay?
I'm good with slow.
She held onto Will's hand as they walked up the hall. Sarah didn't let him go until they reached the supply cabinet. She took out a yellow apron, blue surgical hat, two face masks. She reminded Will, with Alexandra McAllister, there were incised wounds made by a tool similar to a razor blade or scalpel. The killer knew the blood would lure predators to the body. The nerves in the brachial plexus were cleanly severed. The spinal puncture was masked, but I know what to look for. I should be able to tell you fairly quickly if Shay Van Dorn exhibits the same patterns of damage.
Amanda wants you to let her know ASAP.
Does Amanda ever want anything that's not ASAP? Sarah reached up to Will. She tied the face mask around the back of his neck, saying, The vault break dissipated most of the odor. You shouldn't need this, but it's okay if you do. She dressed herself next, wrapping the apron strings twice around her waist, tucking her hair beneath the surgical hat, pulling on exam gloves. Will noted the transformation as she prepared herself for Shay Van Dorn. Sometimes doctors joked around to make light of what was a very grim situation. Sarah never joked. She approached every death investigation with an air of respectful solemnity. Gary had rolled the casket into the anteroom. A clear plastic envelope was taped to the lid. Will saw paperwork and what looked like a window crank that you'd use to open an old aluminum window. Will loosened his tie. The lights acted as heat lamps, boiling the air. They jutted down from the ceiling like robot arms. There were cameras and microphones all around the room, including one that pointed straight down at the casket. A gurney with a folded white sheet and rubber neck block waited for the body. Another table was covered in brown paper to keep the clothes from cross-contaminating. A third table held a magnifying glass and surgical instruments. Gary had laid out a printed copy of Shea Van Dorn's original accident report. Color photographs from the scene were stacked beside them. Will hadn't downloaded the photos from the server. He looked through them now. Shea Van Dorn had been found on her back in the middle of the forest. She had been dressed in a pair of green khakis and a white knit polo. The clothes were shredded where animals had feasted on her breasts, torso, and pelvic area. Her lips and eyelids had been chewed off. Part of her nose was gone. Ready? Sarah waited for nods all around. She tapped a foot pedal to turn on the cameras and mics. Will heard her run through the date, time, introduce herself, and announce who else was in attendance. He couldn't help but think of the Leslie Truong video that had played on the ancient VCR last night. Sarah had looked so different. 8 years later, even though she was saying basically the same things, she sounded different too. I'll perform the preliminary exam in this room. Then Gary will take the x-rays. Then we'll roll her into the autopsy suite. Sarah was finished with the technicalities. She addressed her next words to Gary. Most wooden caskets are held closed with a metal clasp. The more expensive models use a lock that requires a hexagonal key. He asked,
like an Allen wrench?
Exactly. Sarah peeled the plastic envelope off the casket. She tipped out the crank and held it up. This is a casket key. The shaft is longer because it unlocks a metal casket. The lock is always at the foot end, called the foot panel. The panel covering the upper part of the body is called the lid. Can you feel the rubber gasket? Gary ran his gloved fingers along the rim of the lid.
Yes.
The gasket seals the casket, but not hermetically. Remember what I told you about off-gassing during decomposition? If the seal on the casket or vault is too tight, then either or both can explode. Sarah walked to the foot of the casket. Some states require vaults. Others don't. Keep in mind that people are forced to make burial decisions at one of the lowest points in their lives. So, always remind yourself that whatever they choose to do is the best decision they can make for themselves at the time. Gary said,
My grandma was a Georgia fan, so we got a red and black casket with a bulldog on the top.
Will wondered if the young man had forgotten about the recording. Sarah obviously hadn't. She slotted the key into the hole. She continued the lesson, which was just as much for Gary's benefit as a future jury's. Wooden caskets open with a quarter turn to the left. Metal requires several turns. You're releasing the clamps that hold down the lid and the foot panel. Ready? Sarah didn't wait for an answer this time. She braced both hands on the crank. She put her shoulder into the turns. The gasket seal cracked. Will heard a rush of air, not unlike the swoosh from an iPhone, when an email was sent. His hand went to the face mask that hung around his neck, but Sarah was right. He didn't need it. The odor he was smelling was the same sickly sweet odor that had emanated from Shea Van Dorn's body 3 years ago, when she had been hermetically sealed inside the metal box. Sarah slipped her fingers under the rim of the foot panel. She waited for Gary to do the same with the lid. They both lifted at the same time. Will was standing behind Gary, but his height gave him a direct view into the casket. Shea Van Dorn's skin looked yellow and waxy. Bloating swelled her neck. Mold blotched her forehead. She was dressed in a black silk shirt and long black skirt. Her brunette hair was lank around her shoulders. Her cheeks were unnaturally pink and full. Her lips, nose, and eyelids had been expertly reconstructed with mortician's wax. except for the variation in color. Will would have never guessed that an animal had ingested them. Makeup didn't absorb into dead skin. Her hands were folded over her chest. The fingernails were long and curled. She had held onto a small lace pouch for the last 3 years. Sarah carefully removed the pouch. She shook the contents into her hand. 2 wedding rings fell out, one a simple band, the other a large diamond. Will could see tears moisten Sarah's eyes. Her own wedding ring was with Jeffrey's. She kept them both inside a small wooden box. When Will had first met her, the box had been out on the fireplace mantel. Now it was on a shelf inside the guest room closet. Sarah told Gary, "You'll often find personal items with the deceased. Make sure you catalog and photograph them so they can be returned before burial." Gary took the pouch and carefully laid it on the brown paper. "Let's move her onto the table." Sarah dragged over a footstool. Gary found another one by the door. Will leaned against the wall. They didn't need his help transferring the 115-pound body onto the gurney. Gary lifted her by the shoulders. Sarah lifted the legs. Will saw Shay's hand drop down as she was placed onto the gurney. He looked at her bare feet. The toenails were curved, like a cat's claw. He craned his neck, locating a pair of high heels inside a plastic bag that had been tucked inside the coffin. Sarah said, "The waxy substance you're seeing on the skin is adipocere. The anaerobic bacterial hydrolysis of fat develops during putrefaction, the 5th stage of death. It's an urban legend that hair and nails continue to grow. The skin retracts, giving the nails a longer appearance. Embalming fluid can't circulate into the follicles, so the hair loses its luster." Gary moved the casket out from under the cameras and rolled the gurney in its place. He asked Sarah,
"Why aren't her shoes on her feet?"
"That's not uncommon, especially with high heels. Sometimes you'll find underwear placed in a bag at the feet. If an autopsy has been performed, you might find a sealed bag containing organs."
Gary looked taken aback.
"None of that is outside standard industry practices," she told Gary. "Let's get her undressed."
Will kept his back against the wall as they worked. Gary unbuttoned Shay's blouse and laid it on the brown paper. The bra hooked in the front. The plastic clasp was broken. He carefully peeled it away. Cotton had been shoved into the cup where one of Shay's breasts was missing. The material had stuck to the open wound. The arm fell away from the body. More cotton was packed into the armpit.
Sarah told Gary, "During embalming, cotton batting is used to pack the orifices and any open wounds. This keeps the fluid from leaking out."
Sarah tugged down the skirt. There was no underwear. The thighs parted. Will saw more cotton packed between her legs, almost like a diaper. He could not help but think of Leslie Truong, Tommy Humphrey, Alexandra McAllister, and all of the other women from the spreadsheet. Sarah gently turned Shay's head. She rubbed her finger down the cervical vertebrae. Next, she looked at the armpits. She had to use the tweezers to strip away the cotton batting. From 5 feet away, Will could see nerves and veins sticking out of the woman's armpit like a bunch of cables that had been ripped out of a computer. Sarah used the magnifying glass to study the wound. She looked up at Will. She nodded. The puncture wound at C5. The cleanly sliced nerves at the brachial plexus. Shay Van Dorn was showing the same damage as Alexandra McAllister. While Sarah called out the findings for the recording, Will took his phone out of his pocket. He kept it low, out of the camera frame. He texted Amanda a thumbs up. She tapped back an okay. He was about to return the phone to his pocket when he thought of Faith. She was hooked into Will's location services. He saw that she had made good time. Faith was about 20 minutes out from Gerald Catarino's subdivision. He considered sending her a text of encouragement, but a thumbs up felt wrong. Faith had already been forced to deal with Callie's anger on her own. Will didn't know how she would handle it if Gerald broke down again. The sound of the man's sobs in the small closet had been agonizing. Will had been reminded of the new infants that would sometimes end up at the children's home. They would cry for days until they figured out that no one was going to comfort them. He ended up texting her a yam emoji. Faith would understand.
"Why?"
Gary said. Will looked up. Sarah was explaining. "We won't find anything remarkable by opening her eyelids." Will put away his phone. He knew that she meant remarkable in the literal sense. Because of animal damage, the sockets would be empty under the plastic eye caps that kept the shape of the lid. There was nothing to remark upon. Sarah peeled away the wax that shaped Shave Van Dorn's lips. The jaws stayed closed. Sarah laid the wax on the brown paper. She pointed into the mouth, telling Gary, "See the four sets of wires attached to the top and bottom gingivae, or gums?" Gary said,
"They look like bread bag dies."
The embalmer used a needle injector to close the mouth. "The device looks like a cross between a syringe and a pair of scissors, but think of it as operating like a small harpoon. The injector punches a pointed pin with a wire attached directly into the maxilla and mandible. You twist together the top and bottom wires to hold the mouth closed." "I need the small wire cutters." Gary pressed the pliers into Sarah's hand. She clipped open the wires. The mouth slacked open, falling down into the side like the jaw was broken. Sarah pressed her fingers along the bone. "The joint is dislocated." Will could tell from her voice that she was troubled by the finding. He picked up the coroner's report on the cart. The form was standard. He knew that the box labeled Description of Injuries, Summary, was on the third page. His finger followed the single line of text. Animal activity in sex organs, as detailed in drawing. Will studied the anatomical drawing. The breasts and pelvis were circled. The eyes and mouth had X's on them. Nothing was marked in the area of the jaw. The Dougal County coroner was a dentist by training. The man would have noticed a dislocated jaw. Will looked back up. Sarah was shining a light into the mouth. She dragged the footstool back over. From the higher vantage point, she could see directly into the back of the throat. She pressed down the jaw, opening the mouth as far as it would go. Then she used the magnifying glass to look inside. For the recording, she explained, "I'm looking at the upper right quadrant. A piece of latex or vinyl is lodged between the last molar and her wisdom tooth." Gary had picked up on the change in demeanor. He asked,
"Is that weird?"
She talked around the question. "Wisdom teeth generally come in during your late teens or early 20s. Most of the time, they're misaligned. They can crowd the other teeth and cause significant pain. They're normally removed in pairs or all at once. So it's remarkable that a 35-year-old woman only has one wisdom tooth remaining." Sarah stepped down from the stool. The glance she gave Will told him something was terribly wrong. She spread out the photographs from the Dougal County coroner. She found what she was looking for. The latex wasn't there when the coroner took the mouth photos. Gary said,
"The embalmer would wear gloves, right? Because of disease?"
"Yes," she told Gary. "I need the forceps." Sarah returned to Shay's body. She angled the overhead light. She stuck the long tweezers into Shay's mouth. The latex stretched as she tried to pull it out. Then the jaw started to slip. "Steady the jaw," she told Gary. "It's really snagged in there." Gary cupped his fingers on either side of the chin and forced open the mouth as wide as it would go. Sarah tried again, pulling at the latex. The material was thin, almost translucent. Her phone started ringing. The sound was muffled in her back pocket. She turned to Will, frowning.
Could you get that? It could be.
Sarah didn't want to say Delilah Humphrey's name on the recording. Will fished the phone out of her back pocket. He showed her the screen.
Sarah told Gary, I'm going to take this in the hall.
Will followed her out of the room. She kept her gloved hands in the air. She couldn't touch the phone. She told him,
you can hear this.
Will tapped the speaker icon on the screen, then held the phone close to her mouth.
Sarah said, Mrs. Humphrey?
There was static. Will thought they'd let too many rings go by, but the timer was still counting up on the screen.
Sarah said, Mrs. Humphrey, it's Dr. Linton. Are you there?
More static. But a woman's voice said,
What's up, Doc?
Shock flashed in Sarah's eyes.
Tommy?
You got her.
Tommy's voice was deeper than Will had imagined. He had thought of the woman as timid, broken. The voice on the other end of the line was hard as steel.
Sarah said, I'm sorry to bother you.
It's possible you were right about the photo.
Tommy was quoting Sarah's email.
I told you it wasn't Daryl Nesbitt 8 years ago.
Sarah pressed together her lips. Will could tell she hadn't gotten this far, that texting her own mother, emailing Delilah, had been the only step she had walked herself through.
Tommy, Sarah said, I need to know if you've remembered anything.
What would I remember?
The steel turned into a razor.
Why would I remember?
I know this is hard.
Yeah, I know you know.
Sarah nodded before Will could think about how to ask the question. She had told Tommy about her own rape.
Tommy.
Tommy interrupted her with a long, pained sigh. Will could imagine cigarette smoke coming out of her mouth. She told Sarah,
I can't have kids.
Sarah's eyes found Will's again. She held onto his gaze.
I'm so sorry.
Will realized she was speaking to him. He shook his head. She didn't ever need to apologize for that. Tommy said,
I wanted to be happy, you know. I looked at you and I thought if Dr. Linton can be happy, then I can be happy.
Sarah didn't insult her with platitudes.
It's hard.
More silence. Will heard a lighter clicking, a mouth sucking in smoke. Blowing it out. Tommy said,
I don't know how to be with a man unless he's hurting me.
The revelation came out in a rush. Will could see that Sarah was doing the same thing he was doing, slowing it down, trying to find a way around the certainty in the woman's voice. Sarah slowly shook her head. She couldn't find a way. She could only feel devastated. Tommy asked,
Are you that way, too?
Sarah looked up at Will again. She said,
Sometimes.
Tommy blew out a long stream of smoke. She inhaled again. She said,
He told me it was my fault. That's what I remember, that it was my fault.
Sarah's mouth opened. She took a breath.
Did he tell you why?
Tommy paused again to smoke, going through the deep inhale, the slow exhale.
He said that he saw me, and he wanted me, and he knew that I was too stuck up to give him the time of day, so he had to make me.
Sarah said, Tommy, you know it's not your fault.
Yeah, we need to stop asking rape victims what they did wrong and start asking men why they rape.
There was a sing-song quality to her voice, as if she'd heard the mantra in a self-help group. Sarah said,
I know you can't logic away that feeling. You're always going to have moments when you blame yourself.
Is that what you do?
Sometimes, Sarah admitted, but not all the time.
All the time is my time, Tommy said. All the fucking time.
Tommy.
He cried, she said. That's what I remember most. He cried like a fucking baby. Like down on his knees, just wailing and rocking himself like a little kid.
Will felt the air leave his lungs. Sweat beaded up at the back of his neck. Just yesterday, he had seen a man cry that same way. On his knees, rocking himself, sobbing like a child. Will had been standing in Gerald Catarino's murder closet. The father's obsession with his daughter's attack was splashed across the walls. Coroner's reports, newspaper articles, police reports, witness statements, DNA, a brush, a comb, a scrunchie, a headband, a hair clip. No one on earth knew as much about the attacks on Rebecca Catarino and Leslie Truong as Gerald Catarino. Acolyte? Copycat? Nutjob? Murderer? They had assumed Daryl Nesbitt had faked the DNA on the envelope. What if Gerald Catarino was the faker? Will struggled to reach for the phone in his pocket. Faith was probably pulling into Catarino's driveway right now. He had to warn her. Sarah knew something was wrong. She said, Tommy.
His mother was in the hospital.
What? Sarah's stunned question made Will freeze. She had almost shouted the word. Tommy said,
That's why he did it. That was his reason. His mother was sick in the hospital. He was afraid that she was gonna die. He needed somebody to comfort him.
Tommy,
I'm a real fucking comfort.
She gave a bitter laugh.
Hey, Sarah, do me a favor. Lose this number. I can't help you. I can't even help myself.
The speaker clicked. She'd hung up. Will tapped his phone, pulling up Faith's number.
I've got to.
The latex, Sarah said. Will, it's not from a glove. It's from a condom. Grant County, Thursday, 1 week later. Chapter 27. Jeffrey tried not to limp as he walked down Main Street. Exactly one full week had passed since the raid on Daryl Nesbitt's house, and he wanted the town to see that their chief of police was all right. Or as all right as a man could be, with a broken nose, a strained back, and a wheeze in his lungs that sounded like a sick chihuahua. Rosario Lopez had never been in danger, and she hadn't even technically been missing. The student had gone home with a boy she'd met in the cafeteria, and like a lot of students, they ended up spending the day in bed, eating takeout and talking about their childhoods. The manhunt through the woods, Jeffrey's fear that she was being held captive in the shed, were both unfounded. He could torture himself with all the different ways he would have handled Daryl Nesbitt without the possible abduction of Rosario Lopez hanging over his head. But Jeffrey had learned a long time ago kicking yourself about the past would only trip you up in the future. Besides, there were bigger mistakes that he was losing sleep over. Rebecca Catarino was still in a coma. No one could say how much damage had been done to her brain. Everything was wait and see. Jeffrey kept telling himself that she would eventually recover. Becky would never be able to walk again, but she would have a life. She could go back to school. She could graduate. The county's insurance company was already negotiating a settlement with the girl's father. The school was going to pay through the nose. Way down on that list was the fact that Jeffrey would keep his job. For now, at least. Benita Truong had flown back to San Francisco with her daughter's body. She had called Jeffrey twice since then. Each time, all he could do was listen to her cry. There was nothing anyone could say that would lessen her grief. As Kathy Linton was known to say, time was a tincture. Jeffrey yearned for that healing elixir. He wanted the clock to speed up so that he was on the other side of his own sorrow. He had left Birmingham to get away from these kinds of violent, heartbreaking cases. He had thought that Grant County would be his Valhalla, where the worst thing that would happen was a stolen bike or a frat boy wrapping his car around a tree. He told himself that nothing had changed. Daryl Nesbitt was an aberration, a once-in-a-lifetime psychopath. Jeffrey's career from this point forward would be spent shaking hands at Rotary Club meetings and helping old ladies find their cats. He unwrapped a cough drop and flipped it into his mouth. Spring was making itself known from one end of Main Street to the other. Downtown still looked picture-perfect, despite the horrors that had unfolded in the woods last week. The leaves on the dogwoods waved frantically in the breeze. The flowers the garden club had planted were in full bloom. The gazebo display in front of the hardware store was being kept company by a wooden bench. The rack of clearance clothes had been picked clean outside the dress shop. Jeffrey coughed again. The smoke inhalation wasn't the only reason his throat was hurting. He'd spent the last hour arguing with the district attorney and the mayor about the evidence against Daryl Nesbitt. The hammer, the proximity, the phone number, the shed. Jeffrey was filled with dread every time he thought about the homemade prison in Daryl Nesbitt's backyard. The bars on the window and door had been installed with 8-inch one-way screws. They'd had to drill them out to open the door. Inside, they'd found a cot with a pastel pink blanket. There was a bucket in the corner, a pink hairbrush and matching comb. There was also a length of chain attached to a metal ring that was concreted into the floor. No blood, no fluids, no hair, no DNA. The shed looked like a prison cell, but having a shed that looked like a prison cell was not illegal. Neither was working near a fire road that offered easy access to the location where a body was found. Or owning a 1.5-pound mallet that was part of a brawly dead blow set. Or driving a charcoal van. Or your number showing up in the phones of two women who were both attacked. The child porn, on the other hand, was enough to put Daryl Nesbitt away for at least 5 years. 5 years. Jeffrey could work with that. Witnesses would come forward. People would remember things. Tommy Humphrey could decide to break her silence. Jeffrey was dubious of her negative response to Daryl Nesbitt's booking photo. He wanted to put the pedophile in a lineup, allow Tommy time to study his face from the safety of darkness. Seeing a one-dimensional mugshot was very different from seeing a man in person. The biggest obstacle was Nesbitt's lawyer. He was from Memminger, well-versed in the defense of scumbags. The lawyer would fight a lineup. He'd already refused to grant access to his client. He'd wrangled Nesbitt an extended stay in the Macon Hospital rather than in county lockup. Worse, he'd filed a motion to dismiss based on a lack of probable cause to enter the house. If a judge bought his story, then Daryl Nesbitt would be allowed to go free. Jeffrey and Lena were the only two people who could stop that from happening. Both of them had signed sworn statements under penalty of perjury. Both of them were willing to put their hand on a Bible and promise to tell the truth. Both of them knew that everything they said would be a lie. There was a doctrine in law called the fruit of the poisoned tree. Basically, if probable cause didn't exist to enter a residence, then anything the police found once they stepped inside the residence could be deemed inadmissible in court. Lena had definitely stepped inside the house without cause. It was perfectly legal to be inside your home with an erection. It was perfectly legal to refuse to speak to the police. You were even allowed to slam the door in their faces. The mistake Lena had made was grabbing Daryl's arm. He'd pulled away. Instead of letting go, she had stepped inside the house. Then she had taken another step. Then the door had closed, and all hell had broken loose. The "I smelled weed on him" defense had collapsed in that moment. Fortunately, Lena and Jeffrey had been able to arrive at an alternative set of events, where the thing that Frank had warned them about would happen had actually happened. Daryl had grabbed Lena and closed the door. It was worth the giant, "I told you so," Frank kept hurling around. Matt and Hendricks were backing up the story. Jeffrey assumed they thought it was true. The man had been 50 feet away, crouched behind a Malibu. It was hard to tell at that distance who was pulling whom. There were a lot of embarrassing details that were glossed over by the lie. Lena failing to announce that she was a police officer. Matt and Hendricks breaking formation. Brad running into the kitchen and firing off his shotgun. Frank collapsing on the other side of the shed. Lena losing her gun as she chased Daryl up the stairs. And most crucially, Daryl flinging Lena across the bedroom like a rag doll. She'd banged her head against the desk. The laptop computer had been jostled awake. Dumb luck. But still luck. The child porn was the only reason Daryl Nesbitt was looking at a prison cell instead of stalking his next victim. There were a lot of bad things that could happen to a pedophile in prison. Grown men didn't tend to land behind bars because they'd had happy childhoods. There was probably at least one inmate who would be more than willing to take care of the Daryl Nesbitt problem. Barring that, men like Nesbitt tended to find all kinds of ways to keep themselves inside once the walls started to close in around them. Jeffrey stepped off the sidewalk, pretending like the strained muscles in his back hadn't balled into a fist. He'd finished the cough drop by the time he reached the Grant Medical Center. The parking lot was empty, but for the Linton and Daughters plumbing van. He opened the side door, hoping that Tessa would use the elevator. This hope was crushed on the fourth step down. Jeffrey heard whistling. He looked over the railing, expecting to see the top of a strawberry blonde head. Another crushing blow. Eddie Linton looked up. He was smiling. And then he saw Jeffrey. Jeffrey was in no shape to run. Even a fast clip wouldn't do the job. Sarah's father was remarkably fit for a man who spent most of his working life under a kitchen sink or shimmying through a crawl space. Eddie stopped on the landing below Jeffrey. His work belt was low on his hips. Between his plumbing business and real estate investments, Eddie was probably one of the wealthier men in town, but he dressed like a homeless person. Torn t-shirts, ripped jeans. His hair was seldom combed. His eyebrows corkscrewed like fusilli. Jeffrey broke the ice.
Eddie.
Eddie crossed his arms over his chest.
How's the Colton place treating you? Like a man who needs a plumber?
Eddie grinned.
Get a metal bucket. Plastic absorbs the smell.
Jeffrey had to admire the synchronicity.
How long is this gonna last? How long do you expect to live?
Eddie was blocking the stairs. Jeffrey was not stupid enough to push past him, and he was too proud to walk away. Eddie said,
I've been giving a lot of thought to this situation we both find ourselves in.
Jeffrey figured only one of them was in it by choice.
My wife told me something profound when Sarah was born. You know my wife?
Jeffrey gave him a look.
I believe she goes to my church. Yeah, well, she's a pretty smart lady. I remember something she told me when Sarah was born. We were in the maternity ward. I was holding this beautiful little red-headed girl in my arms, and my wife, Kathy, that's her name, told me that I better stay on the straight and narrow because girls tend to marry men who are like their fathers.
He gave a wistful smile.
Right there in that hospital, I vowed to be kind and respectful to my baby girl, to listen to her and trust her, and to make it clear that she should only expect the best.
Jeffrey said,
I know there's a point in there somewhere. The point is, I wasted my time.
He shrugged.
I should have ignored her, so she'd know how to deal with men who treat her like shit.
Eddie grabbed the railing and pulled himself up the stairs. His shoulder bumped Jeffrey's. The pulled muscle in his back screeched like a howler monkey, but he was not going to give Eddie Linton the satisfaction. Jeffrey grimaced as he took a step down. Pain gripped his spine. It was nothing compared to how he felt when he saw the closed door to the morgue. For his coroner duties, Brock used the basement of his family funeral home. Sarah had used the hospital morgue. Her name was still etched into the glass from her last stint in the job. The letters read, Sarah Tolliver. Masking tape covered his last name. Linton was written over it in black marker. Jeffrey guessed he could have chosen a different woman to cheat on Sarah with than the town's only sign maker. He picked at the corner of the tape, but his sense of dignity kept him from ripping it away. He cocked his head, listening for sounds on the other side of the door. He wasn't in the mood to be pounced on by Tessa. He didn't hear voices. He heard music. Paul Simon. 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. Sarah was playing their song. Jeffrey straightened his shoulders. He ignored the twitch of protest in his back. He opened the door. Sarah was on her knees, rubber gloves on her hands, blue bandana tied around her head, as she scrubbed the tile floor. She looked up at Jeffrey over the rim of her glasses. Did you run into my father?
Yeah, he played me the full Gotterdammerung.
She caught herself before she smiled. The scrub brush dropped into the bucket. The gloves came off. She stood up and wiped the grime off her knees. She was in shorts and a paint-spattered t-shirt that had a faded orange and blue Hartsdale High logo on the front. She asked, Nesbitt?
The DA is holding back on everything but the porn charges. Between us, I can't blame him. It's a weak case. Everything is circumstantial, and that's being generous. We're looking at a lawsuit over Caterino. Nobody wants to jump unless we know where we're going to land.
You're certain it's Nesbitt?
Who else would it be?
Jeffrey asked.
Set aside the circumstantial evidence. The killer knows the woods. He knew about the fire road. He was familiar with the campus. He stalked the victims. He stole personal items. He knew their routines. All that points to a man who can easily blend in.
She said, all that points to someone who was raised in Grant County.
Daryl Nesbitt,
Jeffrey concluded. Sarah allowed, he attacked two women within half an hour of each other. It says something that no one else has been hurt since he was arrested.
I'm hoping that a con with daddy issues takes him out before he goes to trial.
Sarah frowned. She had the luxury of not believing in vigilante justice. As a cop, Jeffrey had learned that sometimes you had to skate into the gray areas to make sure the wrong people didn't get hurt. The trick was making sure you didn't spend your life there. She asked, have you talked to Brock? Jeffrey had talked to Brock more times in the last week than he talked to any cop on his force. The man wanted to hear every single detail of the investigations.
I've got 5 voicemails on my phone. He's pretty upset about the attacks.
I don't think that's it, Sarah said. He's floundering without his father. You know how hard it is for Brock to make connections. His family means everything to him. Jeffrey felt guilty for brushing off Brock's calls, which was exactly what Sarah had intended.
He's still got his mother.
I'm not sure for how long, Sarah said. Myrna almost died last year. She was at home by herself and had a bad asthma attack. Brock is the one who found her. It was touch and go for a few weeks. I've seen him cry before, but never like that. He was sobbing. Jeffrey shook his head.
I don't remember.
I only remember the date, because the attack on Tommy Humphrey happened while Myrna was in the hospital. Sarah pulled the bandana off her head and shook out her hair. She explained, Brock asked me to sit with her. His daddy was drunk. Brock was effectively running the business. I stayed with her for a few hours to give him a break. He was so frantic when he came to relieve me. Almost giddy, I guess from lack of sleep and fear. I worried about him the rest of the night. Then I went to work that morning, and Sybil called me about Tommy. Jeffrey got the message.
I'll return Brock's calls.
Thank you. Sarah picked up the plastic bucket. She asked him, did you want to take this home?
I've been told that metal is better.
Sarah was smiling as she carried the bucket to the sink. Jeffrey looked around the morgue while she rinsed out the soapy residue. He hadn't been inside the basement for at least a year. Nothing had changed, but then nothing had changed in almost a century. The hospital had been built in 1930, during one of the county's boom times. The basement hadn't been touched since then. The light blue tiles on the walls were so old that they were coming back into style. The floors were a mixed check pattern of green and tan. The autopsy table was porcelain, with cup sides and a drain at the center. A shallow sink and faucet were at the foot. A scale like you'd find in a grocery store's produce section hung from the ceiling. Jeff? The faucet was off. Sarah was leaning against the counter. Why are you here?
I missed your pretty blue eyes.
He watched those eyes roll in her head. It was an old joke from their marriage. Sarah's eyes were green. He said,
I wanted to tell you that I'm glad you're taking over for Brock. The county needs a medical examiner. Things are changing. Even rural communities are experiencing a spike in violent crime.
Are you testing out a law enforcement workshop on me?
Sorry,
he said.
I'm a little off balance without my emotional scaffolding to hold me up.
She looked at his face for the first time since he'd walked through the door. How are your lungs? Did the doctor give you breathing exercises?
3 times a day.
Jeffrey made a mental note to start doing them.
My nose hurts more than anything else.
It looks broken.
You should see the other girl.
Sarah didn't smile this time. She took off her glasses and cleaned the lenses with the tail of her shirt. She didn't look back up at him until she was finished. Was that really why you cheated? Because I was spending too much time with my family. Jeffrey tried to recalibrate. That's what you said in my office last week. One of the many things you said, Sarah reminded him. That I should have spent more time with you instead of being with my family. Jeffrey took a cough drop out of his pocket. He carefully opened the wrapper. You've forgotten the sequence of events, Sarah said. I didn't waltz into town the next morning and file for a divorce without talking to you. I called you at the motel the night it happened. I was willing to hear you out. Jeffrey remembered his first drunken evening at the Kudzu Arms. He'd had a woman in the shower, and his furious, very soon-to-be ex-wife on the phone. She said, I asked you to go to couples therapy with me. He stuck the cough drop in his mouth.
I didn't want to pay for another woman to tell me I'm an asshole.
Sarah tucked her chin into her chest. They both knew that she would have been the one writing the checks. She said, you could have told me about my family, that it was bothering you.
We weren't talking that much by then.
Jeffrey saw an opening.
Before we were married, we used to talk all the time. Do you remember that?
She stared at him, her expression inscrutable.
I love talking to you, Sarah. I love the way your brain works. You see things in a way that I can't.
Her chin tucked down into her chest again.
It felt like your life turned into a secret that only your family could know.
They're my family.
They're a Jericho wall around you, which is fine. I knew that when I married you.
He told her the truth.
But you asked me what happened. You stopped talking to me. That was a big part of it.
The heartfelt confession earned him a quick laugh. I've never been accused of not talking enough.
I mean about the important things. How you feel. What's bothering you. Problems at work. I used to be a confidant. You could tell me anything.
He laid out all of his cards on the table.
I thought I was marrying my lover. I ended up with a silent wife.
He saw the change in her body, a familiar tension that she always held onto when she was hurting.
This,
he said, trying to keep his voice gentle.
This is what you do when I try to talk to you.
What do you want me to say?
Her voice was little more than a whisper, another indication that she was hurt.
What did you want me to say?
He shook his head. He couldn't do this when she was upset.
Tell me what I did wrong, she said. Tell me, because I'm going to eventually meet someone new, and I don't want to make the same mistake again.
The thought of her meeting someone new made Jeffrey want to tear down the building.
I told you before I was okay with you choosing your family, but sometimes I wanted you to choose me.
Would it have changed anything?
Sarah asked.
You would have found another reason.
You cheated on every woman you've ever been with. You're not happy unless you're in a constant state of limerence.
Limerence?
He tried to take some of the heat out of her tone.
Is this like when you said you wished that I was Semmel Paris, and I was humiliated a second time because I had to look up the word?
She gave a begrudging smile. It's a state of infatuation. It's how you feel when you first fall in love with someone. You're obsessed with them. Euphoric. They're all you can think about.
Sounds great.
It is.
But then you have to take out the garbage and pay the bills and pretend you like your in-laws, and that's a relationship. Limerence gets you into it, but there's got to be something else that keeps you there.
I know you're not accusing me of not loving you.
Jeffrey.
What can I do to win you back?
The question earned him a genuine laugh.
I'm not a trophy.
She had no idea. Jeffrey got out the words before common sense stopped him.
I still love you.
Her body held itself in tension again. He thought about her skin, the soft curves and crevices. They'd had sex just once since the divorce. Sarah had knocked on his door in the middle of the night. She hadn't given him time to ask why she was there. She was kissing him. Then they were in bed. They had both had tears in their eyes. Jeffrey hadn't realized at the time that Sarah was mourning something she had lost, while he was thinking that he'd gotten something precious back.
Sarah, I still love you.
The more he said it, the more he knew it was true.
I'm not going to give up. I'll keep pushing that boulder up the hill until it goes over.
She shook her head, asking, how did that work out for Sisyphus?
I don't know. He's been dead for 2,000 years, and we're still talking about him.
Sarah's smile was still begrudging, but it was still a smile. She asked,
be honest with me. It won't heal things, but it'll help them scab over.
He knew what she wanted, but he said,
be honest about what?
The women. If you want to make this right, be honest. I know it wasn't just Jolene.
She didn't know anything.
I told you, Sarah, it was only Jolene, only a few times. And none of it meant a damn thing.
She nodded her head once, like that settled it. I'm leaving.
Sarah!
My parents are expecting me for lunch.
Jeffrey watched her gather her purse, her car keys. He said,
this isn't over, Sarah. I'm not going to lose you.
She walked toward him. She rested her hands on his shoulders. She raised herself onto her tiptoes so she could look him in the eye. They stayed like that for a moment, locked into each other. She chewed her bottom lip, drawing his attention to her exquisite mouth. Jeffrey started to move toward her. Her hands patted his shoulders.
Turn off the lights when you leave.
Jeffrey watched her until the door closed off his view. Her shadow didn't linger in the frosted glass. On the other side of the masking tape, he could still see the Tolliver. He took as deep a breath as his smoke-damaged lungs would allow. He looked around the ancient morgue. Sarah's office was in the back. He could see she'd brought in cardboard boxes to store her new files, a bulk pack of pens, an unopened stack of legal pads. The ancient compressor on the walk-in freezer started to whine as the motor ramped up. Other than buying a ridiculously expensive sports car, Sarah had made two life-altering decisions the day after she'd kicked Jeffrey out. She'd filed divorce papers down at the courthouse. She'd left her letter of resignation from the coroner's position with the mayor. Here they were one short year later, and only one of those things was still in effect. Jeffrey liked those odds. He took out his BlackBerry. He clicked the scroll wheel to access the notes section. Jeffrey was old school in every aspect of his life but one. He still had a Rolodex. All of his case notes and reminders were written down. He kept a paper calendar. His spiral-bound notebooks were stacked in boxes in his attic and would probably end up in the attic of whatever house he was living in when he retired. Sarah was going to be living in that house with him if it was the last thing he did. Jeffrey looked at the secret list of names and phone numbers on his screen. Heidi, Lily, Kathy, Caitlin, Emmy, Jolene. One by one, he went through the list and deleted them. Atlanta, Chapter 28.